Open our Bibles up to Genesis, please. Genesis 49. You have the privilege of being here for the grand finale. We are finishing another book. I feel the same way every time I do this. It's like leaving a friend. I really get attached to these individual books like this. You spend about a year or so in a book. It's been a little over a year with Genesis now. And you're working on it every week, 52 weeks out of the year. You leave a part of you in the book. Better yet, the book ought to be a part of you. Book of Genesis, chapter 49. We are resuming tonight at verse 28. How many here tonight have your father has already died? Your father has died. All right, just a few. Most of them, 98% of this audience, your father is still alive. I would include myself in that number. Funerals can be, at least your experience in a funeral can be quite objective quite often. You might not have that experience as much as I deal with. Sometimes I've had funerals where I hardly knew the person. And naturally I was just a bit emotionally attached from the situation. But I've had funerals, of course, where it's been as close as my own family. My own grandmother's funeral a year ago. There is a difference, obviously, particularly if you are in charge. But when you attend the funeral of those who are closest to you, it is a very difficult experience. You can talk about it theoretically. You can sit and guess as to how you may react. You can give advice to others as to what they should do. When the time comes, it will be difficult. When we come to the book of Genesis, we've come to a funeral. We end with a funeral. It's ironic, isn't it, that going through the book of Genesis, you begin with an idyllic garden. No death. Everything is right. Everything. And you end at a funeral. Have you ever felt this way when you go to a funeral? What an intruder death is? I went to a funeral not long ago. I had no part in it, but I knew the person. And I'm finding a difficult way to describe this, the emotional sense, that to walk into the funeral, to see the flatbed truck with a pile of red dirt on the back, and the tractor, the men standing to the side ready to move in, and here's a family looking at a casket. Mother's crying, it's her son. Wife is crying, it's her husband. Boys are crying because it's their father. I mean, there's no more of an intruder than death. And being a Christian makes all the difference in the world, but still, death is an intruder. It breaks a relationship. So Genesis ends on what might consider to be a very minor note, a funeral. Two funerals. Father, Jacob, and his son, Joseph. But remember this about the scriptures, particularly the historical section. I've learned this by going through this book of Genesis and Samuel at the same time in the last year. I've been over my head in historical material. Historical material is some of the hardest material to preach on. That's one reason why it's so often neglected. And number two, when it is preached on, it's so greatly abused. I'm not saying that I've done it perfectly, but it's been a challenge to do it the right way, because it's so difficult. But I've learned this one principle, that historical narratives are never for the purpose of being purely historical. We're not reading this as we would sit down and read Will Durant's History of Civilization. Cambridge World History. We're not reading something that God, the Spirit, just thought would be nice for us to know. Is there a lot of other things that why didn't the Spirit give, if that were the case? But the historical sections have theological purposes. One of the great demands on the interpreter of the Bible in extracting the message here in a section like this is to find out, what is the message here? What is the Spirit by Moses teaching us by giving us all these details on two funerals? I think you'll see it. Allow me now to go through this and give you the general plot or what's happened. Then I'm coming back to the subject. My title tonight is When Your Father Dies. But I want you to see the events as they unfold, and then we'll come back to these principles. Verse 29. After Jacob had gone around the room, beginning with Reuben all the way to Benjamin, son, by prophetic insight, he tabbed each of them, mentioning what they had done, mentioning what would be true for them and for their descendants. Then he charged them and said to them, I am about to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre, in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought along with a field from Ephron the Hittite for burial site. There they buried Abraham and his wife Sarah. There they buried Isaac and there his wife Rebekah. And there I buried Leah in the field in the cave that is in it, purchased from the sons of Heth. You read this and you know what your first reaction is? Man, the Bible seems to really deal in trivia at times. Why this trivia? It's not trivia. Wise people understand that what may seem trivial is important. This is not trivial. And I'm not going to give it away. I'd like to give you a test. If I had the time, I'd like to use that pedagogical method. I had a teacher who could do it beautifully in college. I've tried it one or two times and didn't do too well, so I've never tried. But he had a way of asking questions, and teaching, giving content, and getting through with all his material. But he could take responses from his audience like this. He could take a passage like this and ask a number of questions and get it out of you and yet teach his material. I can't do it that way. Maybe someday I could try it and maybe get halfway there. But he could do that. And you'd be sitting there trying to give the answers that he's got, and he'd be drawing them out of you. Of course, you have to do your homework to do that. But if I had the time, I might could try that with you. What I would want to try to do is pull from you, what do you think the theological purpose of all this is? It's giving us all this real estate information. It's a little like picking up a topo. This stake is so many degrees here, and this stake is so many degrees there. So what, you say? When Jacob finished charging his sons, he drew his feet into the bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people. I think that statement, the way it put there, is put, is very significant, that though dead, yet alive. I think that's the Old Testament way of it's giving an open-ended statement to, as far what they knew, there was a reunion with those who died in believing in God and accepting His salvation. I think that's the kind of statement that touches on the truth of life after death. Gathered unto his people. I don't think he's just talking about the grave. Moses is writing this. Now Jacob was 147 at the time. Now the narrative goes on. Joseph fell on his father's face, wept over him. Down to verse 13, you have the elaborate description of getting ready for the funeral, bringing in the embalmers, embalming the body, going up to the land, having the funeral, coming back, the boys become afraid. Uh-oh, Dad's dead. Now Joseph's going to get his pound of flesh. He didn't do anything because when Dad was alive, that was a that was a restraint on him. But now he can have a free hand with us. He won't hurt Dad's feelings. Now, hey, let's get a note to, hey, let's say that Dad said this, so that he will think Dad said this and will be good to us. We're going to come back to that. Joseph weeps. And then Joseph responds beautifully. Then in verses 22 to 26, Joseph, we're given the account of him that he prepares himself for death. And the book ends, "So Joseph died at the age of 110 years, and he was embalmed and placed in a coffin," actually a case, a mummy case in Egypt. All right, that's the overview of the whole passage. Let me come back now and let me show you something about, let me try to do two things at one time. I want to teach you the passage. I want to show you what it says. But I want you to see some principles here that come out of this that I believe will be invaluable for you when your father dies. Principle number one. Principle number one has to do with the father. Jacob prepared himself and his family for death. That's the first principle. Jacob prepared himself and his family for death. How did Jacob prepare himself and his family? Number one, by knowing Yahweh, the Lord. Jacob was a believer. Jacob prepared his family by believing in God and entrusting his eternal soul into the hands of an almighty God. Fathers, I can't think of a better way to prepare your family for your death than for them to be sure of your own salvation. You know one of the most difficult things to have to talk about? Even with the best of friends. I think of some of my closest friends when I've talked with them about this. I'm thinking of one, a very good friend, when his father died. We could talk about it very frank. It's one of the values of friendship. You just can lay all the cards out on the table. You know what that difficult question is? And it's not just with friends, but it's a question that sometimes you want to ask when someone's just died. Sometimes you think, well, it wouldn't be courteous to ask. Don't want to put them on the spot. What is the question? Were they a believer? If they weren't, you feel like you've made them think of something that perhaps they don't want to think about. Were they a believer? Well, I'll tell you what you can do, dads. You can do a lot for your family by giving them the testimony of conversion in your own life, so that when they put your body in that box, that your funeral can have scriptural significance. Well, that's the first thing. Jacob prepared himself and his family. But that's not all about Jacob. Not only did he know God, but yet he was concerned about leaving a testimony. We're going to get a little deeper into it. Now, you remember I asked you the question about why all this mentioning of Jacob's going through all this, burying me here in the field and all that? Do you know what the significance of that is? Jacob wants to leave a memorial. Not that marble slab over top of the ground. They didn't even bury him like that to begin with. He wants to leave a memorial to something. And I think this is the thing that pulls this whole chapter, the end of chapter 49 and 50, it pulls it all together. Because really, this whole section here could be termed three memorials. One is outlined, chapter 50, this way, for instance. Verses 1 to 13, the memorial in Canaan. Verses 14 to 21, the memorial of Providence. And verses 22 to 26, the memorial coffin in Egypt. That's got a lot of merit to it. Because what's the point of this closing chapter? Why all this talk about Canaan and being buried there? You say, well, I didn't think it's all that important where you're buried. What difference does it make, whether it's under a shade tree or by a lake or with a view or what? So what? I mean, why does Jacob want to be buried in Canaan? Is there a better view there than somewhere else? Like we were kidding around here a few weeks ago, we were at a funeral. Maybe I shouldn't chuckle in talking about funerals, but we happened to be on this side of the funeral, so a couple of us were standing there talking with this lady who was trying to get us interested in buying a grave site. And Well, if they're going to ask me to buy a gravesite, I got to put a little leaven in it with a little humor. And I asked her, Bill was the other one. Bill wanted to know if you could fish in the lake. And I asked it, did they allow jogging on the streets around here if we're going to come there? But, you know, you don't look at a burial plot like you're going to buy a condominium or something. So you say, well, Jacob, why does Jacob want to be buried up here in Canaan? What? So was the... Is it better for your body to rot up there? Of course, he's going to be embalmed. So, by the way, that should stimulate some archaeologists, knowing that the Jacob and Joseph, their mummified body is somewhere, probably. But anyway, Jacob wanted to be buried in Canaan. What is the testimony, what is the memorial that he wants to leave? It's something that began back in chapter 12. It's the testimony to the promises of God. God had given to Abraham a promise. Abraham, look out. This is all, look out here. I'm giving you all of this. This land, seed, blessing, but the land. He wanted to leave a memorial. He wanted his mummified body up there in that tomb in Canaan as a continuing memorial that God is going to keep his promise. That as he is buried there and leaves Egypt and goes there and is buried there, that is a testimony to the fact that God is going to keep his promise and is going to give to the sons, the seed of Abraham, he's going to give to Israel that land. That's what he was concerned about. He wanted his family, and they weren't the only ones that became recipients of this testimony, but he wanted his family to look up. They were here down in Goshen now, see, for years. It's going to be a few years yet before they get out. But you know what's going to be up there? Well, they tell you in verse 31, 30 and 31, all those who are buried there. So he wants to leave a testimony. Now, we can't leave that kind of testimony, I mean, just like that. Were I buried under an oak tree or under a pine tree or with a view or by a lake, that's incidental. There is a dispensational distinction here. This was significant because of the memorial. But there are memorials that we can leave that will be a testimony. Could I suggest several lasting memorials that will testify to the promises of God? Number one, the consistency of a godly life right now. That's more important than what they chisel out in that marble over your head. The consistency of your life right now. And that at that funeral, that when that preacher and those people and your family are weeping over your departure, that they can look back and have the fragrance of a godly life. That'll sweeten those tears. It won't take away the tears, but it can make it a meaningful situation. By being conscious of the needs of your family, by being conscious of the needs of your family, wife, and children. This is the way you may leave a lasting memorial to the promises of God. What I mean here is by what you are doing now to prepare your family for your death and their death. Jacob was getting his boys ready for their death, whether they realized it or not, and getting Joseph ready for his death. By what he taught them, what he considered important for them. So not just the consistent life, but what you are doing for other people. The part, what you build into their life. Let's go on. That's the first principle. Jacob prepared himself and his family for his death. The second principle. Now we get to the family. He's in the coffin. The funeral is about to take place. Second principle, Joseph expressed genuine grief for his father at his death. Genuine grief. Threw himself upon, the NIV reads that first verse. Joseph threw himself, wept over him and kissed him. There was a very close relationship between Joseph and his father. That is, I believe, one reason why Moses calls our attention to this fact. There was genuine sorrow. I don't know that I've got to take the time to try to convince you that it's all right to have sorrow at a funeral. Occasionally, though, some people will think that they're being more spiritual if they are superimposed. I think you got to be in control. But that comes within the form of your own personality. Whether you cry or not, of course, that's your own business, nobody else's business. But we should not evaluate somebody on how much in control they are on determining whether they're crying or not. Genuine sorrow because of a relationship. So don't feel guilty for genuine sorrow at a funeral. Being a Christian funeral is not distinguished by the fact that a Christian funeral has no tears. Sometimes I'm almost given that impression. Sometimes people are staying around it, watching very carefully, looking at them. But the difference between a pagan funeral and a Christian funeral is not an emotion, something else. Thirdly, Joseph carried out orderly burial plans. This is discussed all the way down through verse 13. Orderly burial plans. A funeral with scriptural significance, as I've already mentioned, but I want to show you the details now. He planned and worked out an orderly funeral. It was a funeral with scriptural significance. What was the scriptural significance? Let's be sure we get that before we go through the details. What was the scriptural significance? To be buried in the land would be a memorial to the testimony of the unbreakable nature of the promises of God concerning the land. That all of it was built around that. Getting the body ready, taking it up, they have this great entourage. Well, look all that they go through. Number one, they embalm the body. Now, this, I'm not suggesting that's the theological way to handle the body, embalm it. That was just the Egyptian methodology. Though Joseph did bring in the physicians and not the professional embalmers. There was a difference. The professional embalmers, they would use a lot of mumbo jumbo, and it was a big religious deal, embalming the body. But he's using the physicians here so to avoid all this magic, all this mysticism of the professional embalmers. That's why he mentions physician. And the embalming method was quite an elaborate method. It's mentioned here in verses 2 and 3. It says, now 40 days were required for it, for such is the period required for embalming. And the Egyptians wept for him 70 days. Now, this embalming process is quite elaborate that we know how they did it. They'd take the body, you know, weak stomach, hang on. They'd take the body, and on the left side, they would just make an incision, take out all the organs, and then they would take out the brains, run a hook up the nose, pull all the brains out, and then they would take natron, and they would bathe the body in this. This took care of all the moisture in the body. It dried the body out. And they would then sponge the body off, wipe it off, and then they would wrap it in, again, natron, which would further take all the moisture out and mummify. They did a fairly good job because we've still got the mummies on. I saw one up at the Museum of Natural History up in Chicago, and they've done a pretty good job. And that's the process that they did with, followed through on with Jacob. And then they go to the Verse 5, there's a phrase there that's the focal point of the entire funeral. Behold, I am about to die in my grave, which I dug from, this is what his father said, in the land of Canaan. So Joseph requested Pharaoh that they be able to go out of the land and bury him up here. And they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan. I'm at verse 10 now. They lamented there with a very great and sorrowful lamentation, and he observed 7 days mourning. So it's interesting. I don't know why they had to do this, but if you checked it out on a map, an atlas, they went this way. I don't know why, but they did. They came up from Egypt. The quickest way to have been to go right up here, the burials. But they didn't. They come around. They come this way. Some have suggested there was some political upheaval in the southern part of the land. So they had to sweep around, and they came in from the northeast that way. But that's where they've gone after that detour. And look, all the Egyptians, isn't it interesting? One of these Egyptians thought this. They say, well, I guess a few days off from work won't hurt anybody. They hardly knew that this was Joseph's father. I guess they were so appreciative of Joseph that out of respect for his father, well, Pharaoh said to go, He went, all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his household, all the elders of the land of Egypt. What an entourage. I mean, talk about a funeral procession. Just moving right out of Egypt for days and moving on up around the Dead Sea, coming in. And then they go into all this lamentation and mourning, and the Canaanites are wondering what's going on. I'm going to get to that in a minute. But that is the third principle. Joseph carried out orderly burial plans with scriptural significance. Here is why scriptural significance is important at a funeral, just as it is here. Number one, it's significant because of the contribution it makes to the family. You should plan the funeral and conduct the funeral so as to be of benefit to the family. Scripture, prayer, music if you choose, the message by all means. When you have a part in a funeral as a member of the family and you are to give suggestions, in some cases you may be the one to make a lot of final decisions. Try to make that funeral scripturally significant for the benefit of your family. Another benefit of the scriptural significance of a funeral is that it's significant because of the presence of unbelievers. Who was there? The Egyptians. I don't think all these Egyptians were believers. Worshiped probably their own gods. They're in this funeral, though. This funeral procession. And who else is aware of what's going on? Where does it say it? Verse 11. When the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, they said, "This is a grievous mourning of the Egyptians." Therefore, it was named Abel Mitzrayim, which is beyond the Jordan, or the meadow of Egypt, because the Egyptians were there. But the Canaanites saw all this, heard it all. You see the lesson here? The scriptural significance of a funeral is there for unbelievers too. You'll always have unbelievers at a funeral. Just figure on it. Because what do funerals do? They gather a family together, family members that haven't seen one another in years. It gathers people, friends, and associates. Many hardly ever darken a church door. But at a funeral, everybody at least pays their dues to religion. They at least come and give a nod to God about this whole thing. As far as I'm concerned, it is a great occasion. When you've got people there who are to lesser and greater degrees in a sense of sobriety, they're thinking about death, and you know everybody's thinking about someday I'm going to be there. And you've got them. And my policy is you've got them, they're up against the wall. Respect the fact that they're there with their rights for their privacy. But listen, they're there with needs, and that is the time for the gospel to be presented in a way which they can understand that Jesus Christ is the answer to death and resurrection and eternity. That's how a funeral can have scriptural significance. If your father dies and he's not a believer, you don't have to have in the eulogy that to give anybody a false hope. You protect that. You should be very careful about letting anyone give the idea that this person was a believer, and you know, and a lot of other people know they probably weren't. You just leave that in the hands of God. But do project this, that what they need, the funeral is for the living, not the dead. That's the difference between paganism and Christianity. It is for the living. And you communicate that because you're going to have unbelievers there. What can you do when your father dies? You can see that that funeral has scriptural significance. There is a fourth factor involved in this funeral. Joseph was true to his promises made to Jacob. Joseph was true to his promises made to Jacob. He promised him that they would bury him in the land of Canaan. And they did. But if you do make promises, and it is not involving some immorality or illegality, fulfill those promises. but you should be careful as to the kind of promises you make. If you're dealing with a mother or father and they're on their deathbed, sometimes that can be such an emotional situation, you would be apt to make a promise. Maybe that you're going to move somewhere or that you're going to do something for someone that maybe would violate some principle in a relationship. But for the promises made. But maybe let me draw it in a little closer. I think this is a legitimate way in which you may carry on. Take the funeral as a challenge to carry on something that this loved one leaves. If it's a Christian, it's just a beautiful setup. Because if it's a believer, then you can have this sense of carrying on something that they've given to you. For instance, you can take it as the opportunity, if they were a believer, that you can carry on as an intercessor. They can no longer intercede. They can no longer pray for others. You can intercede. You can be a counselor and a comforter to the other members of your family. If your father is a believer, you are left something. You are left with a responsibility for leadership in a family in a very real sense. I personally felt very, this is a hard thing to describe, unless I guess you who've been through it, you recognize, you know the sense. When my grandmother died, she is the spiritual matriarch in the family. And I mean spiritual matriarch. She is responsible for so much in the family spiritually, through prayers, through faithful witness. Personally, I felt some sense of obligation that God, now that He had taken her, that I felt that here's the time to move into the gap in a special way. Because there's one less intercessor. And I'd better move in that gap. Because there are some people that she's praying for. And I've got to continue to pray for them, see? It's like this. It's like a relay. And you're moving here and you're waiting for the baton to be passed. And it's in your hand. You go. That's it. It's legitimate. Now, I'm not talking about morbidity. Trying to identify with a person so much that you lose your own personality and you're trying to live their life. No, that's not what I'm talking about. But I mean those spiritual enterprises in which they were engaged, witness and prayer. Take that baton and carry it on. There's a fifth factor involved in this funeral of Joseph's father. Joseph carried no grudges after the funeral, after the burial. No grudges. It is fantastic. I'm going to come back to what the boys did, their reaction. That's a principle. But I'm impressed with what Joseph said. Isn't it beautiful? He said three things. Look in verses 19, 20, and 21. Look what he said. This is after the boys said, "Hey, Joseph, Dad says be good to us. Don't beat us up." Joseph, he got that letter, and Joseph, he wept. Why do you think he wept? He's probably disappointed. He had hoped that they believed that he had forgiven them. And why didn't they believe? But he says three great things here. Look what he says. Number one, do not be afraid. I'm in God's place. First thing that Joseph evidenced here was that he left the righting of all of the wrongs to God. God would take care of that. It was not his job to get into this business of revenge, dealing with them for their sin. The second thing that he said, verse 20, "And as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result to preserve many people alive." He saw God's providential hand in their evil toward him. The third thing that he saw, therefore, do not be afraid. I is emphatic in the Hebrew. I will provide for you and your little ones. So he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. He repaid the evil with forgiveness and practical affection. Hey, there's a man who holds no grudges. There's a man who holds no grudges toward. He is in a very influential position. He could have done something to them. He could have made life miserable for them. But this, the fact that he didn't do anything against them, that's not the whole picture. I mean, an unbeliever could be that way. But he went the second step. He even took step for practical affection and provision. May I suggest some principles for action with regard to this matter of funerals and grudges and that kind of thing? What you can do at a funeral in terms of, number one, pray for God's purposes to be accomplished during and after the funeral. This is no time to be involved in any grudge, resentment, but rather pray that the purposes of God will be accomplished during and after the funeral. That's one of the first things you should do when you find out your father's dead. When you pray for God's purposes to be accomplished. Second, anticipate the special needs of the bereaved. Your brothers, your sisters, your mother, your dad's parents, friends. Everyone will have special needs. Anticipate the special needs the bereaved will have after the funeral. Your mother and her loneliness. She's lived with him, shared life with him for years. There will be loneliness. You can move in and minister like you've never ministered before. Look for special ways to help alleviate the needs for some of those who need a visit. A card, a call. Seek to meet those needs that you've anticipated. And here's one. Remember the special needs of smaller children at such a time. Smaller children. You know, they're easy to get lost in the shuffle. The little people. Could you keep them over here to the side? I tell you, I had a good model of this. It was not long. I had no part in the funeral, but it was interesting to watch this pastor. You learn things negative and positive when you watch somebody else do these things, and I learned something positive this time. This minister took all the children. The father died. There were a lot of grandchildren and children as well, but he took the little grandchildren. He took them aside, and he told them all about the death of their grandfather. He was a believer. And gave them some teaching and comforted them. I thought that was good. To take the children aside and take it as a time to teach them and to comfort them. To deal with their feelings. See, they don't know what's happening, why they feel a certain way. They don't know how to react. Don't forget about the little people at the time of the funeral. When your father dies, if there are grandchildren, nieces, nephews, let's don't forget the little people. It might be that God would want to take you and all the training you've been getting, that God is training you for a time when you could take about 5 or 6 little people. You could just take them aside. You don't have to make a big issue out of it. Just take them aside and talk to them very tenderly, very quietly. Listen, what God has done in Jesus Christ to provide for, He provides eternal life and a resurrection body. And if this one who died was a believer, it makes it even more beautiful, then you can explain the significance of death for the believer. Don't forget the little people. Joseph did. I'll provide for your little ones. The sixth principle, Joseph's brothers. This is the bad story. Joseph's brothers were gripped by guilt and fear upon their father's death. Joseph's brothers were gripped by guilt and fear upon their father's death. Proverbs 28:1. The wicked flee when no man pursueth. That's not the wicked flee, but get this now. There's no flee here who's wicked. But the wicked flee when no man pursueth. You know that. They're always looking over their shoulder. You got a good case of it right here. Let me go through, sir. You see the situation. They said, verse 15, what if Joseph should bear a grudge against us and pay us back in full for all the wrong which we did him? So they sent a message to Joseph saying, your father charged us before he died, saying, thus you shall say to him, Joseph, please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and so on. Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Jacob didn't say anything like that. They lied. Why do people feel guilty at funerals? This was an old wound, old scar that's been rubbed again. Why do people feel guilty at funerals? I want to suggest 4 reasons why people often feel guilty at funerals. One is because of wrongs committed against the deceased. They did something wrong. They cheated that person, or they said something hurtful to that person. And they are emotionally bent out of shape, and they're carrying on because they are guilty because of what they've done to that person. This is a message for all of us. Don't let your tears have to be tears of guilt. When that loved one is in that casket, make sure that you're not standing there crying because you wish that you had asked forgiveness or you hadn't made those cutting remarks. And I guarantee you, you'll be tempted to feel guilty because of that. I mean, you'll have to deal with that even if you've confessed them and they've been forgiven. So better yet, don't even commit those kinds of sins against that person. That's another reason why people are guilty at times of funerals. Shortcomings and failures to achieve goals. This is a hard one. This gets very personal here. No relationship with a person. We had it this morning. If only. If only. If only we'd had a relationship. You may not ever be able to develop a relationship with your father. But if you can, try. If only. Wrongs committed against other members of the family. Wrongs committed against other members of the family. This is the case of Jacob, Joseph and his brothers. They were plagued with guilt because of what they had done to Joseph. Now that the father is out of the picture, that focuses on what they had done. A sin committed against a brother, a sister, a mother, or an aunt, or an uncle. And then unconfessed sin of some type or another. It may not even be related to this, but it's just the thought of death and its finality that breaks off the scar and the wound bleeds because of unconfessed sin. Those are some of the reasons for guilt at funeral. What are some of the symptoms of guilt at funerals? I only suggest these. Please don't try to make yourself a spiritual cop at the next funeral. Go around trying to nail people. But these are factors. Sometimes, symptoms of guilt at funerals. Lavish funeral arrangements may be an attempt to assuage your conscience. Lavish funeral arrangements. I can't judge motives. Sometimes, I'll be honest with you, I wonder, why all this? Somebody feel guilty here? Are they trying to do for this person in death what they never did in life? They're providing something in that casket they never provided for them while they were alive. And those flowers, it's not wrong to buy flowers. I've passed the word along to Beth that when I'm out cold in that casket, that's my earthly tabernacle, I'm with the Lord, and let's just try to be reasonable about this flower business. Now, I'm not expecting flowers to come from all over the world, don't get me wrong, but maybe I'm just too practical here. I can see just enough flowers to break the monotony, but listen, that money that can be spent in that funeral can sure go out to the living. Get the gospel out. Something like that. I think, frankly, we just waste a lot of money at funerals. I think it can be done tasteful. And don't let some funeral director intimidate you either. Get you in there and all of you are worked up and you can't, well, we've got this. And you know what's going through your mind. You go all the way from the expensive down to the cheapest. It's like, oh, we can't let Dad go in that cheap thing. Let's give him the best. Who are you kidding by thinking like that? That's pagan. Now you find what's appropriate. Now, if funeral directors find out what I'm saying, they might want to run me out of town on this. But I'll tell you what, there is an awful lot of non-Christian activity that goes on. We just blow everything when it comes to doctrine, when it comes to funerals sometimes. Just blow it all. Just like the unbelievers. Waste a lot of money. Sometimes lavish funeral arrangements. Sometimes emotional hysteria, loss of control. Emotional expression is, of course, not wrong, but it can be an expression of guilt, an awful lot of overt emotional hysteria. Rash promises and vows. Major decisions without calculation. I'm going to move. I'm going to sell my house. I'm going to sell my car. I'm going to take a vow, poverty, something like that. Strange behavior. Just say strange, bizarre behavior. It could be a list quite long. That the way guilt begins to show itself. What's the remedy for guilt at a funeral? Well, we had it this morning. You know, I just refer you back to the message this morning. Confession, reevaluation of your life's priorities, restitution possibly. Maybe God deals with you in such a way as a funeral, there is some restitution you need to make toward another family member. Take care of it. Reevaluate your life at a funeral. That's why I think funerals serve a useful purpose in several ways, and that's one of them. It's a time to sit there and reevaluate your whole life. And that when you are laid out there, what will be the evaluation of your own life? Are you living in view of eternal values? The seventh principle, we've got to finish this up. The seventh principle, Joseph committed himself to care for his family. I've dealt with this in measure already, but it's worth repeating as a distinct principle. Joseph committed himself to care for his family, to take up the slack, to stand in the gap. I submit to you that you, at the time of the funeral of a loved one, your father, stand in the gap of intercession. Stand in the gap of example, model of Jesus Christ. Stand in the gap of exhortation and comfort for other family members. Stand in the gap of physical needs. Your mother's going to have needs. Your brothers and sisters and others, they're going to be needs. And God brings you before to that situation to be a minister of God's grace in very practical ways. Now we come to the last fact, and that is in verses 22 to 26. Number 8, Joseph in his own death perpetuated the promises of God. Like father, like son. Joseph, in his own death, perpetuated the promises of God. Joseph said to his brothers in verse 24, I'm about to die, but God will surely take care of you. Here, he's doing just like Dad did. He's ministering to his brothers, his family. Bring you up out of this land to the land which he promised and on oath to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. That's a great statement. He is living a testimony, a memorial. God is going to keep his promises. Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, God will surely take care of you. You shall carry my bones up from here to where? Up there to Canaan. In keeping with his belief in the promises of God. And Joseph died at the age of 110. So his bones, until they left, always a witness to what fact? His bones are witness to the fact that they were going to return to the land of promise. And do you know what? Lest you forget, and I forget, Hebrews 11:22. You may not think that's all that great, but the writer of Hebrews did. Under the direction of the Spirit, by faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the exodus of the sons of Israel and gave orders concerning his bones. You know what that says? How a Christian funeral is distinctive? Is that when you die, it's in a context. There is something that's greater than your death. And that is the God of the death. The God of eternity and his promises. Now, that's the kind of memorial that you ought to leave. A witness to the significance of death in the Lord. And the promises that God has given to us as his children. In our funeral, my funeral, your funeral, should give off that fragrance and that testimony. Hey, now that's a good kind of a memorial to leave. I see some rather elaborate memorials when I go to cemeteries. But you know, the only people who ever see those are other people going to funerals. I mean, I've seen some elaborate ones. I'll tell you the best kind of memorial, and that's the testimony of the life, and even in the death, of a God who will keep his promises. Let's close in prayer. Father, may now through this study, that your Spirit will use this truth for us as you take our fathers in death. Grant us a ministry to them before they die. Perhaps, Father, there are some who need to get in touch with that father. A letter, or call, a visit. And Father, we need the grace to know what to say, how to say it. Father, we need your guidance and your providence to work for us, to help us prepare our father for death. So Lord, use us this time to, through this study, to make us a ministry in that way. In Christ's name, amen.